You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Neil and Julie for the past 2 hours, but now at 12 p.m. it's time for Bums on Seats. If you're new to the show, then we're all about forgoing the sunshine and heading into the dark to view the latest cinema releases. Over the next hour, we'll decide which new films are worth staying pale for and which are best ignored so you can catch some rays. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show this afternoon are Sarah Dillon.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Hello.
Kevin Hilton.
Hello.
And Mark Livesich.
Good afternoon.
Today's show throws some light on the art of adaptation as we look at four new films that draw their influences from four disparate mediums. When they're not busy buying up superheroes and Star Wars, Walt Disney Studios are busy reinventing their own back catalogue with new release Maleficent, a live-action rewrite of Sleeping Beauty. Meanwhile, period drama Belle finds its inspiration in an 18th century painting of Lady Dido Elizabeth Belle, a West Indian girl who grew up among high English society due to a serendipitous birth. Oh, I get serendipitous right. There's a definite tip of the hat to video game repetition in Doug Liman's Edge of Tomorrow, with Tom Cruise as the army major forced to relive his first and only battle over and over and over again. And Clint Eastwood keeps the changes to a minimum as he moves the Four Seasons biography, Jersey Boys, from the Broadway stage to the big screen. Plus, we catch up with the situation at the Abbeygate Cinema in Bury St Edmunds, until recently a beautifully refurbished member of the Picture House chain. Its fate looked precarious after the Competition Commission demanded that the Cineworld Group dispose of one of its two cinemas in the town, but after a recent sale, it's now operating as a truly independent cinema. We have an interview with a new owner. That's all to come, but we begin the show with a Once Upon a Time.
I shall bestow a gift on the child.
Before the sun sets on her 16th birthday, she will fall into a sleep like death.
I know you're there. Don't be afraid.
I am not afraid.
Then come out.
Then you'll be afraid.
Is it true? Are you Maleficent?
Earlier this year, Disney's Frozen, their animated adaptation of The Snow Queen, passed $1 billion at the box office, proving that despite the studio's purchase of Marvel, Star Wars and The Muppets, their main strength still lies in their knack for rewriting fairy tales. But fairy tales are finite. A new release, Maleficent, shows Disney's plan is now to mine their own past animated masterpieces for live-action inspiration. Scripted by Linda Wolverton, Maleficent is Sleeping Beauty from another angle, with the iconic Wicked Witch of the original, now the star, and the comatose princess, confined to a mere supporting role. Angelina Jolie plays Maleficent, not the monster as originally depicted, but the benevolent protector of the fairy kingdom of the Moors. The one time she allows a human across their border, she falls in love with him, but she is deceived, her heart is broken, and her mighty wings are cut from her. In an act of brutal revenge, she curses the first child of the human king, promising that when the princess reaches her 16th birthday, she will fall into an eternal sleep. Mark, to begin with you, and I know everybody in the room's seen this. Why? Disney have a lot riding on Maleficent. They've pretty much given up creating new stories over the past year in favour of revisiting old classics. We had Alice in Wonderland a couple of years ago, for instance, and Oz. But is this a fresh spin on a classic yarn, or is this just Disney devouring its own tail greedily?
I think 6-1, and I don't think in either side that's a particularly good thing. I do think that this is becoming really unnecessary now in terms of Disney's product. When you see the likes of some of their individual studios, the Pixars, the Marvels, consistently producing new works, quite why Disney has decided to go down this route of just regurgitating old stories with slight tweaks is beyond me.
Well, franchise, it's a brand name. They're only after brand names. Maleficent, oddly, considering it's quite difficult to spell and it's taken us all a bit of time to practice, is a brand name. They're scared of anything else.
It is, but it doesn't, by any stretch of the imagination, feel different enough to justify another go-round. To be honest, if you're going to make a live-action version, you might as well just make the traditional Sleeping Beauty story, because actually what gets lost in translation is any sense of the fable or the moral that would have come out of the original. Everything is slightly more muddied. Angelina Jolie gets to have fun for about 30 seconds and then just simpers around in the background, and any sense of reality or any sense of integrity in her character just disappears, and the whole thing is a washed out mess.
Sarah, do you feel the same? Is this a good way perhaps of Disney coming in and changing some of the gender issues that the original Sleeping Beauty had? This is a much more, this features much more proactive female characters than most Disney animations, or most films, to be fair, up until quite recently.
Absolutely. I disagree with Mark. I think the slight tweaks that it makes are really actually important. I've got a 2-year-old daughter, and I'm looking ahead to what she's going to be watching as she grows up, and I don't want her to always be watching films in which the women are subordinate to the men and they're relying on a magic kiss to make them all right in the world. You know, I was really actually pleased by Frozen, that it had that twist at the end and that it was the sacrifice of the sisterly love that saved her. And the same thing, okay, a little predictable after Frozen, the true love kiss wasn't from the man, it was from the maternal, the mother figure. But I think that's powerfully important for young girls growing up, is that fairy tales are notoriously sexist. And the fact that they're being rewritten for an age in which girls should be growing up having a sense of their own empowerment, I think that's really important. And I actually quite enjoyed Maleficent because of that.
I wouldn't disagree that's an important message for young girls. Surely they deserve something better to have it wrapped in than what's been served up here.
Well, we've got to start somewhere, haven't we? So why don't we start with rewriting the old stories, and maybe that will inspire a generation of new young women to go into screenwriting to write the original ones that we don't have.
What age group does anybody, what demographic? I'm constantly bemused now by most modern blockbusters. I don't know what age group, what demographic they're aimed at. Kevin, this is a dark and moody film. There's barely a break of sunlight in it. Thematically, it's quite complex. It's quite interesting, but there's not much plot. Did you enjoy it? Can you find out who this is for?
No, not really. For me, it's not really the film I would watch anyway because of its, as you say, the demographic that it's aimed at. The only thing that did sort of have any interest to me was the idea that you were going to see a movie from the villain's point of view. But most disappointingly, after sort of about 10 minutes, the idea of like, oh, this is a bad guy's point of view of everything, they've just turned her into a good guy instantly. And so that whole angle that they're promoting the film on is totally lost, which is a shame because it's an interesting kind of direction to go in. And say, I was hoping for something a bit more sort of sinister, but the only thing sinister about it seems to be that it's dimly lit.
That's Hollywood sinister.
Yeah, well, I thought like the only sort of cynically, the only sort of person who would have been scared by it is Tim Burton, because they've figured a way to make a Tim Burton film without having to pay his extortionate paycheck, I imagine.
And Linda Wolverton wrote the Alice in Wonderland, the dismal Alice in Wonderland that came out a couple of years ago, which rewrote Alice at this mischievous Victorian creation as a Disney princess, This is why Mrs. Banks wasn't happy.
I saw in an interview that Mia Wasikowska is thrilled about the fact she's in a two-film contract to do the sequel as well. So, perils of signing up to things like this, I guess.
I'm sure it will be spectacular. But, Dave, this has, again, like Alice in Wonderland and last year's Oz, which I liked more than Alice in Wonderland, but they all share this with Maleficent, this shiny CGI world look, which actually gets more pronounced as this film goes towards its end. So actually, when we're supposed to feel genuine human emotion, we're constantly being distracted by the fact they're obviously all on a green screen. Do you find this look... You see a lot of these films, like myself, are you gradually just being worn down by this appearance?
Yeah, I'm starting to get... If it's really well done CGI, or if it's, you know, little CGI tweaks in the background, it's perfectly fine with me. But, yeah, get people off the green screen, please, and put them back in a set where they belong. I mean, there was the scene, you know, at the end in Sleeping Beauty's chamber where everything is turned up, flipped upside down, whatever you want to do to it. That bit I actually liked because, as far as I can tell, you know, it was a real place. But... The moors were just inhabited with all these creatures, and they were just tired redesigns of fabled creatures I've seen before. They didn't seem to be reinvented, which was a shame. And it didn't look particularly good either. So Angelina Jolie does have wings for some of the film, and you could tell she was being hung up on a string somewhere with a giant fan in her face. There's better artists out there than that these days, and you know, if Disney want to make a film like this, they've got to get them involved.
Sorry, Mark.
Just to come in on the point, nothing feels fresh or new. You've got the section at the beginning where there's a sort of battle on the moors, which feels lifted from Lord of the Rings or something similar.
Snow White and the Huntsman as well, yes. The moors itself.
You've then got all of the moor sections. And again, you go through every section of the film and everything feels like it's been lifted from somewhere else. Nothing feels new or original. It's just almost a supercut of bits of fantasy films of the last 10 years.
Barely a plot, sir.
Is that to do with... It's Robert Stromberg who directed it, yeah, and that's his directorial debut.
He's another effects artist.
Yeah, but yes, that's what's interesting, because his history... I mean, you mentioned Oz, you mentioned Alice. He was on the production design for... all of those films. So there might be a fact that he is actually literally drawing off the previous films that he's been involved in, bringing it into his first directorial role, but not having then taken it and done anything else.
I imagine he's a safe pair of hands. I think this film, there's some signs and there's some rumours on the internet that it was heavily edited in post. There's a lot of stuff that looks like green screen with nobody else around, scenes that don't look like they need to be green screen. Angelina Jolie's not actually in it very much. She's impressive when she is, or she's fun when she is, maybe not impressive, but there's a lot of tinkering. I think they just needed somebody to get the mood right, and then they moved in with the effects crews and sorted it all out, probably for on minimum wage. Did they do enough with Maleficent? It's, as Kevin points out, you're not watching a bad guy, you're very rapidly watching a good guy, so they don't really do very much. And we spoke earlier about giving a role model to your daughter growing up, but do they actually... push her away from being a two-dimensional cartoon? Because in the end, there's probably not a topic for 12:15 in the afternoon, but there's a very heavy, deliberate rape analogy,
yep,
in the cutting of the wings.
Yep.
But she still, which is interesting, in the fact that she rises above this being destroyed in this manner, but she's still a female character who's a queen for all intents and purposes at the beginning of the film, though not a name, but she's still defined by the actions of a man.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think what's interesting about the whole villain thing is it reminded me of Wicked, with that idea of it, they're still villains, but it's kind of the psychology behind how they became villains. So it's not that simple black and white, there's the goodies and the baddies anymore. It's that there can be a baddie, but how have they ended up being the baddie? And perhaps they weren't always the baddie and they're not going to stay always the baddie. So in that sense, I thought actually the sort of the attributing of psychology to behind baddies characters is quite interesting. But you're right, although it's switched the story so that the women are playing powerful roles, does it go far enough? I don't know. It's definitely about maternity. It's about the change that happens to her when she falls in love with the child. It's not her own child.
But is it such shorthand that it becomes rather trite and offensive? Or is it possibly the fact you mentioned that the fairy tales are by most fairy tales,
well,
by the very roots?
Most fairy tales are trite and offensive as well. If you're a woman,
it's true. But they are also lessons, and they're quite dark and mean. And Disney have destroyed that over the last two, three decades. They've gradually watered these things down until they're just lunchbox illustrations. And I thought, is there a possibility here that at least they're bringing back a little bit of the Brothers Grimm to the thematic qualities of the film?
You want there to be a moral as such?
They are lessons in life. That's what. Yes. That's in a way, that's how they developed, and that's how they were captured and written down. There might be an element of that back in this film, however tritely it might be handled.
I think Maleficent is defined by her relationship to the man, but every human being is defined by their relationships to other people. That's how we develop the experiences we have. That's how we become the people that we do. I think what for me was most interesting was the way she was defined by the developing relationship with the young girl and the baby, and how that changed who she was and made her remorseful, and that relationship was the intimacy that saved the girl, not the man riding in on his white horse and giving
in fact the men are entirely useless and hopeless and not very pleasant,
prince. The final scene, that final montage, it's Maleficent and the girl that are sort of central, and the guy who plays the crow is kind of off to the side, and the young man who you think is going to become her eventual love is also off to the side. And I thought that positioning was quite nice, that the men were pushed out and that the focus was on the women at the end.
I think this is all interesting. I just think it's completely undermined by the cheap, tacky approach of the rest of the film. It's the director might have had, Robert Schomburg might have had those. I'm sure he had those ideas. He wanted to explore those themes, but in the end, it's just another. To me, anyway, then perhaps the mark to finish off. It's just another theme park ride.
I think crucially for me, it fails to entertain. In the screening I was in, there were some young children at the back who were repeatedly telling their parents how bored they were. Ultimately, if you can't succeed on that level, for any other achievements you might make in terms of any sort of moral gains or any details about sexuality, if you've missed entertaining, you've missed the point.
Yeah, it's not going to get repeated and messages aren't going to sink in, and it's not going to have any resonance at all, and like Frozen.
And when actually one of the big points of this is exactly the same point that Frozen was trying to make, and it almost replays that plot point for point. Just go and watch Frozen again, because that's great.
Okay. Maleficent opened a couple of weeks back and is still screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas in 2D and 3D versions. It is a certificate 12A, a dark certificate 12A, a darkly lit certificate 12A. British movies have a tendency to sit themselves in one of two camps. Either you're a glorious period piece full of frock coats and flirtatious dancers, or you offer the social realism of the kitchen sink drama. But new release Belle, the first film in over a decade from promising director Ama Asante, is based on a story that combines both popular flavours. Scripted by Misan Sege, Belle takes its inspiration from a unique 18th-century portrait, an oil painting that captures the young Lady Elizabeth Murray alongside her mixed-race cousin, Dido Elizabeth Belle. Belle was the illegitimate daughter of a sea captain, but rather than being left to struggle in slavery, her exalted parentage placed her in the care of Lord and Lady Mansfield. Though it takes a while for them to become accustomed to their exotic new granddaughter, played in the film by Gugu Mbatha-Raw, they are determined that she'll be treated as equally as society's rules will allow. But Belle is always aware of her fragile position in the household and her impossible situation outside of it. Meanwhile, Britain's role in the slave trade is finally beginning to make the public feel uneasy.
Elizabeth was in much need of a companion.
And that is what we shall say when questions are asked. We shall be receiving visitors for dinner.
Why do you not dine with your family ever?
Because that is not correct.
May I present the second of my two nieces, Miss Dido Lindsay?
I find her repulsive.
Papa, how may I be too high in rank to dine with the servants and too low to dine with my family?
Though I understand she is kept under interesting rules, she raises questions.
Would you do me the honour of taking some air with me?
Don't you care what people will say?
What should anyone say?
I have no idea I should be so black.
One does not make a wife of the rare and exotic.
Does she still have a tongue?
I have a tongue.
Though yours explains well enough why I may not marry your son. My greatest misfortune would be to marry into a family who would carry me as their shame.
Sarah, Belle's director, Ama Asante, has suggested the combination of race of crinoline, which is Elizabeth Belle's story, is remarkable. Does she do this remarkable story justice with this film?
No. That's a quite simple answer. No, there are so many things wrong with this film, I don't even know where to start. I know that she's talked in an interview about when she was a girl, she started off being an actress rather than a director, and she was watching all these kind of Jane Austen-style period dramas, and she wanted to see a black character who was not a servant or a slave within it. And I can understand that sense, a little bit like what we've just been talking about, as a young black woman growing up wanting to see yourself represented in a way other than as a servant. And in a way, this film is a kind of fantasy wish fulfillment of her childhood dream. But to do that whilst dealing with a topic as horrendous and significant as the Zong massacre, where these slaves were literally jettisoned so that money could be claimed for their loss, is almost, for me, verging on negligent, actually. I found it really, really difficult film to marry those two concepts and to believe that a period drama with all its beauty and luxuriousness was the appropriate medium for tackling such a really significant moment in history.
Is that the case, Mark, that they're not making the right film here, or rather they're confused about what the film they're making? There are very important, extremely interesting topics on their table, and it just descends into melodrama a lot of the time, with dastardly villains and handsome but bland suitors. Is that a problem? Did you find that? What did you think?
I actually quite enjoyed it.
Should have asked that first, sorry.
They say that men often marry their mothers, and I can certainly say that both my mother and my wife are huge Jane Austen fans, so I've seen Colin Firth step out of a lake dripping wet more times than I'd care to mention. I'd like to think I know my way around a Jane Austen, and it certainly, you know, had the feeling of that era and of the better Jane Austen adaptations. In terms of the tone, it was light and fluffy at the right moments. It was serious at the right moments.
It doesn't, that damns Jane Austen. This doesn't have anything. Having somebody in crinoline doesn't make Jane Austen. There's nothing of the complexity of Jane Austen in this. It's just Sunday night tea time television.
The other point about Jane Austen, though, is that she was writing about a very enclosed, specific world. And, you know, Austen scholars have talked about this. She didn't write about anything that was happening historically outside of her little circle. She does that circle brilliantly, and the film does that circle brilliantly, the way in which women are just got to be traded, you're useless if you haven't got any money. All of that's done really well, but that works in Austen because she's not trying to tackle anything serious outside that world. And to take that film and do it Austen-like, but then have this kind of parallel narrative of a significant moment in the slave trade history, is just wrong for me.
It didn't sit well for my. It's one of those films where characters who've been together, presumably, you know, for the whole 30 years they've lived outside of this film, talk. We only meet them when they're talking in exposition, like they've never spoken before. When Belle walks by the side of the lake with Tom Wilkinson, who plays her adopted grandfather, when he says, "Why can't I eat with the family?" Really, you haven't had this conversation before. You're just having it now for our benefit. It was filled with moments like that, and there were two sort of interesting elements which it never expanded upon, which fitted both themes it's working with, the sort of the Jane Austen style romance and the 12 years of a slave style reality, is when she sees the painting which has a black character in it who is merely a slave, simply somebody for them to rest their feet on, and when she claws at her own skin in front of the mirror. Even that scene, which is powerful, sits difficultly because she's clawing at her own skin because she can't go to the ball. And that's interesting, but they don't develop that theme. Her gradual awareness of the position of the rest of West Indians in the UK or back in the West Indies, it comes from nowhere. And I don't know.
I did feel actually they did develop some of the themes. The one for me which did feel underdeveloped was the whole nature of illegitimacy, because that's dropped in maybe about two-thirds of the way through. Oh, actually, it wasn't the reason of your colour, it was your illegitimacy.
Yes, that was interesting as well, yes.
That did feel like it was the one that got short shrift in terms of the various bits of the narrative. I think where I would position this film is if I wanted say, a family member to sit down and watch something like 12 Years a Slave, which actually did deal with those issues well, I would use this as the lead-in to almost soften them up, get them thinking about those kind of issues, and then go, actually, here's a really good film.
I hope people don't need to be led in like that.
That's really worrying, that we might still live in a time where people cannot just be confronted with the brutality and the reality of the slave trade, that they need to be eased into it via petticoats and petty love affairs.
Clearly you haven't met my mother.
Well, no, maybe careful. Not. Maybe not. Maybe not. But, you know, my mother went, you know, loves Downton Abbey, but she went to see 12 Years a Slave, and she came out, you know, feeling guilty. She'd recently been, actually, to an old slave plantation, and she hadn't really realised when she was there that the hotel she was staying in, what its history was. She watched 12 Years a Slave. She came out, and she had that burden of kind of white guilt. And you can't carry that burden forever, but we still live in societies here and in the States where there's massive differences between racial poverty and achievements. And so it's important to keep that in our memory, and I don't think we should be cushioning it. You could have done a fantastic film about the Zong massacre, and you could have done a fantastic film about that painting, you know, the kind of girl with a pearl earring type looking at a painting and spinning the story out of it. There could have been a wonderful film about that painting. There wasn't a wonderful film that tried to do both of those.
There could have been a brilliant film about several different aspects of this film. We've already had the Zong slightly covered in Amistad, so we've already had that slightly dealt with. But I don't know. To me, it felt borderline offensive.
Yeah,
and it's but it's coming from a director of color. It's coming from writers of color. In the end, it doesn't matter. This is not the story to tell, and you don't make up history around one element of truth, which is the painting. She didn't go on to marry an abolitionist. She married a sort of high member of staff. No, you're lying about an important aspect of history. I can't abide that. I think this is...
But you can level that accusation at pretty much every film that attempts to make some kind of dramatic recreation of life.
And I don't think they do it to this degree. I think this is so little known here. I don't know. We have to wrap up, or we'll have 10 minutes for everything else. But
all you can say, sometimes you take the things in context, and I double build this with Oculus. So having come out of a horror film, I was quite happy to have something which was light and undemanding and hinted at issues without necessarily getting into them. If you're looking for something that's going to make a deeper exploration, yes, I would say this is probably not the film for you. If you're looking for something which is light and entertaining and might make you think after the film rather than during it, then I'd recommend it.
Okay, well, all right. Bell opened last week and is still screening at the Arts Picture House. It is a Certificate 12A.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Quick bit of listings. This coming Monday, June the 23rd, the Arts Picture House is screening the thrilling Mexican drama The Golden Dream. Well worth seeing at the best of times, but this screening is made even more compelling by the presence of the film's director, Diego Diaz, for a post-film Q&A. It begins at 6:30. Last year, in a not altogether surprising decision, the Competition Commission decided that the Cineworld Group's purchase of Picture House Cinemas created an unfair cinema monopoly in three locations: Aberdeen, Bury St Edmunds, and of course Cambridge. Aberdeen's Belmont has since been sold to the Centre for Moving Image. It's still to be announced which of the Arts Picture House and the Cineworld multiplex in this city will be sold. The fate of Bury St Edmunds' Abbeygate Picture House was particularly tenuous. The old two-screen Canon Cinema, it's where I first saw my first 18 film, the hugely risque Fatal Attraction, has been lovingly refurbished by the Picture House Group, with an expansive bar and an adventurous programming for a quiet Suffolk market town. There was a threat that may all be lost with the inevitable sale, the bar torn out for a third screen, the program made to mirror the multiplex up the road. But about a fortnight ago, after months of negotiations, it was announced that the Abbeygate had been bought by Tony Jones, a familiar face to Cambridge film audiences as the man behind the Cambridge Film Festival and the Cambridge Film Trust. He also, a few years ago, co-founded City Screen, a group that would eventually become Picture House and would eventually be bought by Cineworld. Wheels within wheels, as Jeeves would say. Mark Liversidge spoke to Tony Jones about the purchase of the small cinema on Hatter Street, what it meant for long-time employees such as the general manager Pat Church, and how it would affect the cinema's programming. But first, he got the lowdown on what attracted Tony to venture once more into cinema ownership.
the reasons for going in there against other offers was to protect what's there. And it reminds me of how we started off in Birmingham. We had a small little cinema there, only 100 seats or so. I mean, going back to Bury now, we've got 117 and 70 seats. There's a great management and customer-facing staff operation. It's better than anywhere else, really. Mm. And the bar and cafe are as good as any everyman or curzon. It might not have such a young, trendy audience in there, but at the end of the day, the food and the offer and the service is brilliant. And that's worth an investment.
In terms of actually making it work then as a cinema, it's gone from being part of a small chain a few years ago to part of a bigger chain of about 20 cinemas in the past 2 or 3 years. So I'm presuming it's now a genuine independent again. So what kind of challenges does that pose in terms of the independence now of making it a going concern?
I'm less concerned about being an independent against a multiplex in terms of booking the right sort of films for the venue. I think that's probably a plus factor, really, in that Bury will get very personal service. Mm. Having started off building something up from scratch, this is like a new start. And I mean, and it's a bit crazy as I'm approaching retirement next month to be taking on a project like this. But hey, it's going to be a good fun ride, and I just think we can get. I mean, it makes a good profit there, and it's been competing with the Cineworld anyway. And the films that we would lose to the Cineworld are probably the films that we're happy to lose anyway. And those the classier titles will do better in Hatter Street. So that's been proven, you know, the last couple of years or so.
Yeah, it's very much a back street cinema, isn't it? It's a little gem, but it's hidden away, and almost if you're not quite sure where it is, do you think there's still a need to build a bit of an audience? Because it's less than 2 years ago since the refurbishment. So is it still in the process of building that clientele at this point?
It probably is, but I mean, I just need to. I'm not going to tell Pat and Jonathan if they've been out there legging the streets and getting flyers out, because there's lots of residential in Hatter Street, and maybe we'll just do some offers for the Mondays and Tuesdays just to get them coming in at a special rate, maybe offer a special discount for membership. But just we want to be, I mean, it should be their local, and there should be so much going on there, and the fact that you can dine out there really well, that it's they're the people we need to get coming along.
Is it something now that to make it thrive has to become more of a rounded offering? Do you have to try and make more of the cafe to help the cinema to help the cafe? Does it become more of an integrated unit now to make the whole place thrive?
It has to be an integrated unit, and we want to try, and not in this next programme, but probably the programme after, our deals and special offers, so that every week we're going to try and do something a bit different. Either it might be a free meal if you strike lucky with your membership card number, when we've got everybody transferred to Abbeygate Cinema membership cards. And then alternately, we might just do a free cinema offer if you're dining with having two courses or something. But we've got a great food offering there, good bar space. And I go there on a couple of Friday nights I've been there, and there haven't been many people dining in at the front of 4 Hatter Street. So we've got to get that.
Back to effectively the programming and your role in it. I don't know how much you can say about actually the way that you've got in and the purchase has happened, but is it pretty much now free rein for yourself to do what you'd like to do within the Abbeygate?
The main programming will be handled by picture houses, but as a virtual contract, as they do across the country for some 20 or 30 other venues, where picture houses don't own the site, but they offer a programming service, and that's how we'll continue to run Bury for the time being. And then I'll look at the infill material, which I find more interesting, to think somebody can look after the bread and butter, than just to get the Film Society titles in and special events.
The membership as well. I know from speaking to people at Aberdeen, which changed hands at the end of March. that effectively at that point all ties got severed and they effectively have had to try and rebuild their membership base from scratch. Is that kind of handover proving difficult in terms of the Abbeygate transition?
I mean, why would you want to screw that up? I mean, that's what's that's essential part of the very business is the membership. So it's essential that that moves as smoothly, that we honour all the Picture House membership cards until they expire, and there'll be a reciprocal arrangement so that Cambridge or Norwich Picture House card holders will get a discount at Bury, and the same for Bury Abbeygate holders will get their discount here. The tickets can't be redeemed at Abbeygate Cinema. Free tickets can't be redeemed at other Picture House venues, but the discounts will apply. And that seems a good, sensible business practice. I mean, why would you want to turn somebody away if they've come with a Norwich card and happen to be in the area? You want to get their business.
You mentioned as well that you're a month away from retirement. So what at this point has tempted you back in? What made you feel that you couldn't not take up this opportunity?
Well, when you know people, and I've known them for the 3 years since at Bury, and Pat's, you're buying in 40-plus years of experience. He's very good with the customers, and he was projecting the other day, and I was just down then, I was just going through the programme with him and bits and pieces, and he's got to go and get the next film started, and then we're looking forward to doing some of the Chinese films which are on 35mm. So if when we put those in the programme, we'll make it clear that they're being projected by Pat or Ian on 35mm. And all the staff there are very committed. The thought of it being sold off, because Cineworld was certainly not going to sell the Cineworld in Bury, so it would have been had to have gone, and it could have had a fate worse than death. I mean, you could have had a pizza bar there and run of the mill commercial titles, utterly pointless.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Tony Jones for finding the time in his busy pre-film festival schedule for the interview, and to Mark here for travelling into Cambridge to ask the questions. You can keep up to date with what is happening at the Abbeygate Cinema at their new web address, abbeygatecinema.co.uk. Plus, they're on Twitter, still at @abbeygateph. That may change in the future, but it's still that at the moment. You are listening to Bums on the Seats on Cambridge 105 FM, community radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Sarah Dillon, Dave Riley, Kevin Hilton and Mark Livesich. Just a very, very quick rundown of what's still to come on Cambridge 105 today. Julian Clever will be here at 1 p.m. with Summer Saturday, which today is reporting from the Cycle of Songs, the Chesterton Festival and Norfolk Street Summer Event. Then from 4 to 5 will be Bookmark. From 5 o'clock will be Radio Dante, followed an hour later by the pop music and chat of Jason Allen, leading in the Club Global at 7 p.m. That's all to come this afternoon. We've still got another 20 minutes of the show to go. We'll wrap up with Jersey Boys, but before that, we're going to do the first 30 minutes again, until we get it right.
I'm going to tell you a story. At first, it's going to sound ridiculous. But the longer I talk...
We have to find the keys.
The more rational it's going to appear.
I can't believe you found coffee.
Sugar, right?
Yeah.
Hold on. Three. You like three.
How many times have we been here? How many times?
For me, it's been an eternity.
This is not...
The invasion will fail. We lose everything. I die within 5 minutes of landing on that beach, along with every other soldier.
Get down! How did you do that?
Come on!
Come find me when you wake up!
Whilst this summer's crowd of cinema blockbusters have been surprisingly strong, they've still been dominated by the usual gluts of remakes, reimaginings, sequels and prequels. Though based on a novel and with a plot that's redolent of numerous other time travel films, Edge of Tomorrow feels like a novelty. In an era of films as franchise segments, this is a film with a beginning, a middle and an end, though not necessarily in that order. Set in a near future when the Earth is being rapidly colonised by an alien force, Edge of Tomorrow stars Tom Cruise's Major Bill Cage. Unusual for a Cruise character, Cage is no hero. Rather, he's a fast-talking salesman who has swelled army numbers with his advertising campaigns, but has no stomach himself for the fight. Indeed, when forced into battle, he's dropped on a crowded French beach during a vital counter-strike, he is killed almost instantly. But then he wakes to find himself on the morning of the previous day, set to run the whole sequence of training, landing and death all over again. It seems he's become trapped in a loop, set to run the day until he perfects how to survive. Kevin, Edge of Tomorrow had an oddly meek marketing campaign that sort of made it look like Oblivion Part 2. The studio didn't really seem to know what they had. Is it worth audiences discovering this under-the-radar film, really?
It didn't do anything for me. I can't sort of say enough bad things that it was to say to anyone to avoid it. But it was just kind of 2 hours. It just sort of played out for me. A lot of it looked exactly like I've seen in other films. The concept is, of course, predictably a sort of action movie version of Groundhog Day. Certainly nothing bold or new or exciting about it. If you're a Tom Cruise fan, then it's the kind of stuff that Tom Cruise does quite well.
Is it? I mean, he's played different characters before. He's rather been typecast more in the media's eye than his own performances. But he is playing not just simply a character, but he has a complex arc in this film, I found.
I didn't think so much. I thought his part at the beginning was quite interesting, where he sort of plays a timid, you know, sort of scaredy cat, sort of,
A coward who tries to blackmail his way out of
fighting. But again, that's quite interesting. It's Tom Cruise usually likes to cement himself as a hero sort of quite early on in films, which is why I like Vanilla Sky, where he sort of has somebody whose ego gets sort of taken away from him. But again, after 20 minutes here, he's sort of, once you figure out what's going on and he figures out what the mistake is and he becomes cool very quickly, sort of thing. There was a potential of it, but I didn't think again, I thought it was very quickly Tom Cruise after about half an hour.
Dave, there's a complex narrative here. I mean, in terms of blockbuster, it's not overly complex in terms of what's happening, but it's the same thing happening again and again. Does the director, Doug Liman, who's a bit underrated, he did the first Bourne film, which I think personally is the best of the four Bourne films, is this the most interestingly directed? Did he keep sort of the balance of this tricky narrative? Did he make it, keep it lightweight, make it make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I managed to follow the film perfectly well, and I was watching it very late on a Friday night, having done a two-hour journey to get to the cinema, because I wasn't in Cambridge. And, you know, I followed it. It made sense, it made cohesion. There was a little bit at the end where it was a bit kind of, oh, how can we make this, you know, ring true so that we have our happy Hollywood ending? And that bit I was like, I would have preferred it if you'd gone the original way. Because he is capable of doing darker things. I mean, you do look at the first Bourne film where, you know, it isn't all happy Hollywood ending. It's quite a dark ending, really. He's strolling off into the unknown. But in Edge of Tomorrow, it's waking up to a bright new dawn, I guess is the way we describe it. And that bit was a bit for me. But the rest of the film, you know, it's a simple enough concept. You have to keep going until you do something right. And, you know, Tom Cruise fully embraces it. The bit I liked the best was when he actually did seem to do a bit more kind of acting, is when he finally decides, you know, the way that they keep trying to solve the problem isn't working and he strikes out on his own. And he all of a sudden, he kind of turned on a dark, brooding intensity version of himself. And it was like, oh, it's nice to see him back again. I haven't seen him since The Last Samurai. So that was a welcome return.
I thought it played interesting. The video game thing passes me by a little bit because I'm not a gamer. I can see the direct references and trying a game. But I thought it played interesting games of the blockbuster format. Mark, if I briefly come to you, in that these ridiculous action scenes that all the stars are in, which I don't mind, I'm not against them, they're great if they're executed well. This shows how he has to go through we don't know, hundreds of lifespans in order to be able to do even the simplest battle. I thought it played interesting. It used its science fiction concept well to play with ideas of how blockbusters work.
The one thing which did seem interesting, which was maybe slight evolution on Groundhog Day, is that sometimes you're in a scene and you can't work out whether they've been through that before, whether it's the first time they've got that far, whether actually they've already failed and actually are trying something different. And that it did play with that conceit quite well. I think the only real objection I had to the film was that I still need someone to explain the ending to me, and I'm willing to offer beer, chocolate or flowers to anyone I can do so.
Well, we don't want to go into the ending too much because I want people to go see it.
It makes no sense. It logically makes no sense. I physically cannot work out how what happens at the end happens. I would love someone to explain that.
Did they not just destroy the alien's ability to see into the future, therefore destroying its main battle plan?
Spoilers.
Well,
yes. Yeah, people can find me on social media or
No. Am I right?
No.
You're bypassing. I think that's what happened.
Without saying, how does Tom Cruise end back up at the point he ends back up and then see the events that have happened in the way that they've happened? Because surely they wouldn't happen if he ended up back at that point. It's on a par with Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes remake in terms of nonsensicality of its ending. I think I've just made a word up, but anyway.
It's okay. I do them all the time. I just put them into a script and get away with it. Sarah, coming on to you briefly. I was quite surprised, actually, by Kevin's muted response, though. Out of a summer blockbuster, I thought this was splendid. I thought it was clever and did a lot with its idea and made and used its star well. It got as much acting out of him as it could, but it made gentle fun of him all the way through, and he was up for that. I thought that this was a really pleasant surprise.
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, I watch a lot of science fiction films, and it was a bit like kind of 50 First Dates meets Source Code. It was a kind of bizarre
That's how they
combination.
Sold it.
But, it, you know, it was funny, it was cheeky. I hadn't read anything about it before I went in, so I wasn't expecting that reset. That was, you know, I was actually surprised by a Hollywood science fiction film that I was like, oh, right, we've gone back to the beginning. Okay, let's see what happens. I agree about the ending. I'm keeping quiet because I don't want to ruin it, but I think there is you don't understand why he wakes up at that moment. I think you can understand why he goes back, but not to that specific moment. And I also like the fact that you're right, that we're kind of in the same position as the woman, in that she doesn't ever know whether they're doing something for the first time or not. So we have a kind
We've not mentioned Emily Blunt at all,
yeah,
as Rita, the warrior.
She's a little bit of a cipher, but, you know, at least she's a kind of powerful female.
Yeah,
figure.
She's not defined by Tom Cruise.
and you're so that. But she's almost us in the film because she doesn't know what's happening. So we have a kind of nice as an audience. We have a nice kind of character that we can relate to in it. I thought it was great fun and really entertaining.
And she never becomes a damsel in distress. She's important to the plot all the way through until the very end. She's her own element. She operating as you say suggests because of the way she's our character. Dave, you wanted to come in here with a bit of logic?
More or less the point you've just made, that it was really nice to see how Tom Cruise had to evolve during the film. Emily Blunt got to maintain being this firm, strict character, even at the very end when, you know, they turn up and they have the same meeting again. She still hasn't changed and she's still looking like she could crush him like the bug he is.
I like the scene where he goes to the pub, but one reality where he chooses not to fight at all and he goes to the pub, which gives you a hint of how old he actually is now. Because he's sitting with people in their 70s and 80s who call him a coward. At this, in his timeline, that's how old he is. He's already lived and failed this beach attack 70, 80 times already. We don't know. It could be hundreds of times. And before that, it's the hundreds of times that Emily Blunt tried it. And when she could time travel, I find that all... I think it throws enough of that in. But I agree with you, the ending doesn't quite land. But the voyage is enjoyable enough. I'm willing to think you're all cowards for bringing it up. Okay. Edge of Tomorrow opened on May the 30th and is still screening at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a certificate 12A. In his 34-film long career, director Clint Eastwood has made an attempt to shake hands with every genre in the room. Westerns, biopics, war movies, romances, thrillers, even supernatural weepies and hokey science fiction. His directorial curiosity has been insatiable. But new release Jersey Boys is his first out-and-out musical, though he saves the dancing in the street until the very last moment. Closely based on the long-running, multi-award-winning Broadway hit, Jersey Boys is a true story of pop group Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons, a tale of rags to riches and back to rags again. Age 16, Frankie Valli knows his only hope to escape, the only hope to escape his dead-end New Jersey home is his miraculous falsetto voice. His friends, including gangster wannabe Tommy DeVito, enlist Valli to lead their doo-wop group, where his unique sound attract the attentions of a gifted songwriter. But no matter how many number one hits the group has, they can't seem to escape their tough New Jersey background.
You want to hear the real story? I'm the one you want to talk to, Tommy DeVito. Wasn't for me, we all would have wound up with a bullet in our head.
Friends like that, you should change your name to Sinatra.
I'm going to be as big as Sinatra.
I would love to introduce you to a new discovery of mine, Frankie Valli. Dream of
wild, I heard them all, but I never heard a voice like Frankie Valli's. I know I need to write for this voice.
Success now. The records, the TV, the personal appearances.
Who lets you breathe, baby? Who's gonna help?
They asked her, what was the high point? But four guys under a street lamp. First time we made that sound, our sound. That was the best.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Four Seasons!
Dave, adapting stage works can be tricky at the best of time, and Clint Eastwood, for the last 15 years or so, hasn't been the most visually interesting of directors in terms of camera position and blocking. Does his Jersey Boys sing? Not literally, because obviously they do.
Obviously they do, as you said. I'm going to be honest. I went to see this, so I didn't have to watch the football, and I think I enjoyed it more than I would have had I been to see the football, but it just felt a bit flat and lifeless, apart from the bits where, as you say, they were singing. I mean, it didn't do anything amazingly well. The actors were all pretty good in their roles, but I didn't feel really engaged with any of them. You know, they've got these real-life characters to inhabit, and they didn't really kind of bring them to life enough for me for it to be, because it's quite a long film, and so I wanted to have them, you know, if they're going to do this, they've got to do it well for the entire length of the film.
Although the actors, some of them are the actors from the original stage show, the gentleman, John Lloyd Young, who plays Frankie Valli in the film, who played Frankie Valli in the first stage run, which is a problem. It's good because he's fully invested in the role. I disagree with you there. It's bad because he's supposed to be 16 at the beginning and he's 38, and he looks 38, and all his teammates, all these fellow band members, are also in the late 30s, so it looks a bit weird.
A difference between the way he's used to expressing himself on the stage and when you suddenly have to express yourself to a camera.
Yeah, there is a difference. Yeah,
I don't know. I don't think he liked working with the camera. Maybe, or you're not sure.
But then Frankie Valli's a fairly bland character anyway. I mean,
that as well. It's all right trying to inject life into something, but if there wasn't there much there to begin with, until they start singing, of course. Then, you know, that part of the film for me was wonderful. So if they could have just done the songs, yeah, fine.
Mark, does this, at the very least, the first two-thirds of the film, I felt just about did a fairly good job of capturing, out of context, you never see the Beatles, you don't know any psychedelic explosion, folk rock music, none of that happens in this world, this universe of the Four Seasons and doo-wop. But I felt it did a sort of good, it captured the tawdry, transitory nature of fame quite well, I felt. And that's the limited amount I could get out of it, I think.
I think you're reaching, if I'm being brutally honest. I thought most of the first hour was a complete washout because there's no sense of dramatic tension or plot development at all. I think you could take most of the first half an hour and just overdub it with people saying, "What are you doing? Forget about it." And actually, it would make no difference because you wouldn't have lost any sense of plot.
It would have been less racist.
Yes. I mean, there's an odd point that there is a character which is Joe Pesci. And that's maybe where I've taken inspiration for my rather offensive accent from. And I'll apologise to anyone that was offended by that because it wasn't intentional. But it is the level of stereotype that permeates the film. One of my favourite Simpsons episodes features a character who describes himself as an old Italian stereotype. These genuinely feel like people who are one step away from admitting they are Italian-American stereotypes.
I think that's why I was a bit sort of benevolent towards it when I was watching, at least for the first two thirds. The final third after the Four Seasons break up is horribly dull, horribly stagey. But
well, there's also another thing in terms of the structure, which again I think is mirroring the stage play a little too much, in that you have the first half of the film where nothing happens, and then there's a point where they go, ah, but actually it wasn't all like this, and skip back 2 years, cram all of the tension into a very short period, and then it goes very dull again. Then actually they could have paced the beats of the film if they hadn't stuck so rigidly to the structure of the stage play and actually thought, what can we do to improve or develop this? Then they could have actually paced the dramatic beats better and made more of it, which no in it.
Is the film trying to get away with things that maybe this, I'm not a fan with the stage, with the Broadway musical, but it's offensive in terms of the characterizations. I don't find so much the Italian males. They reminded me of the young Italian mothers, men in Fellini films in a way, just lost and looking for something to do in their lives. But the gangsters, sort of cuddly Christopher Walken's gangsters, is a very stereotypical gay music producer. I'm sure it's fairly lifelike, but it's over the top. The women are treated badly, and it never questions any of this. It's just uncomfortable, I felt. It was just, I don't need to see this world presented to me, these aspects of it presented to me without commentary, I felt.
I mean, everything feels homogenized for the screen. You've got the world's least threatening gangster bookie, who's one of the Four Seasons has got heavily in debt to, who just sort of occasionally turns up and goes, "Can I have some money, please?" And then wanders off again. And you think, actually, when you've got a six-figure debt in the time this was set in,
$500,000, doesn't it?
Yes, they're all being rather casual about this, and you know, there's never any sense of feeling of reality. I think when you look at what these jukebox musicals are, it's a chance to relive the songs of a particular band or a particular era. If you like the music of the Four Seasons, how much do you care about the drama that's in between? The problem is it's 2.25 hours, so there's an awful lot of drama in between, which doesn't go anywhere.
There's actually very few songs. There's a sort of middle batch of songs, which is fine, and then he very quickly, once the Four Seasons breaks up, becomes a crooner, becomes middle of the road, and has his middle of the road sub-Sinatra songs, because he hasn't got any jazz chops. And I found that kind of interesting on a sort of technical point of why, how MOR developed. But
you've also got a problem in terms of the structure of the songs, that most of the songs in the middle, the well-known songs, the likes of Sherry, are very samey. You get two very different songs in the last quarter of an hour. You get Can't Take My Eyes Off You and Oh What a Night. Oh What a Night isn't even from the period of the Four Seasons in the film. It's from the mid-70s. Hmm. I mean, only Frankie Valli was a member of the group at that point. Just not thought through. On top of which, Clint Eastwood's direction is showing signs of age. There are whole scenes where he gets the shot composition completely wrong. Characters almost at the edge of frame when they're having a conversation. There's one scene in the end montage when the four of them are dancing and one of them disappears out of shot because he's not moving the camera with them. That frustrated me. It feels in the hands of a better director, and I think someone else was attached before Clint Eastwood.
Jon Favreau.
Yes, who I think would have put more life into this. It does feel limp and lifeless for large stretches.
Okay, well, I have to wrap it up there. Jersey Boys opened yesterday, Friday the 20th, and is currently kicking back its Italian heels at the Arts Picture House. It is a certificate 15 for swearing, mainly. That is all the time we have time for on the show this afternoon. The whole shebang will be repeated tomorrow at 7 a.m. and will be available to listen or download shortly after that. We will be back on July the 5th with Chef Fruitvale Station, something on the Cambridge Film Festival, only 66 shopping days left until that, and something about the R-screen notion that is sweeping into picture houses. We'll play out with some of the music of Horses to Men, the Icelandic drama that is still enjoying a good run at the Arts Picture House. Stay tuned for Julian Clover and Summer Saturday, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.